also.
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 Adhikaha.
Adhikaha.
Greater.
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 Yogi.
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 The yogi.
Tasmat.
Tasmat.
Therefore. Yogi.
Yogi.
Transcendentalist.
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 Baba.
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 Just become.
Just become.
Arjuna.
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 O Arjuna.
O Arjuna.
Translation by Srila Prabhupada. A yogi is greater than the aesthetic, greater than the empiricist, and greater than the fruit of worker. Therefore, O Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. I'll phrase it, you can repeat after me. A yogi is greater than the aesthetic.
A yogi is greater than the aesthetic.
Greater than the empiricist.
Greater than the empiricist.
And greater than the fruit of worker.
And greater than the fruit of worker.
Therefore, O Arjuna. In all circumstances. Be a yogi.
Okay, so we're all going to mute now. Please.
Muting.
Okay, so purport by Srila Prabhupada. When we speak of yoga, we refer to linking our consciousness with the Supreme Absolute Truth. Such a process is named differently by various practitioners in terms of the particular method adopted. When the linking process is predominantly in fruitive activities, it is called karma yoga. When it is predominantly empirical, it is called jnana yoga. And when it is predominantly in the devotional relationship with the Supreme Lord, it is called bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga, or Krishna consciousness, is the ultimate perfection of all yogas, as will be explained in the next verse. The Lord has confirmed herein the superiority of yoga, but he has not mentioned that it is better than bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga is full spiritual knowledge, and therefore nothing can excel it. Asceticism without self-knowledge is imperfect. Empiric knowledge without surrender to the Supreme Lord is also imperfect. And fruitive work without Krishna consciousness is a waste of time. Therefore, the most highly praised form of yogic performance mentioned here is bhakti yoga, and this is still more clearly explained in the next verse. The yogi is greater than the aesthetic, greater than the empiricist, and greater than the fruit of worker. Therefore, Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. Om Gyan Taramandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Umlitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Actually, I've prepared something for this class, but in the word for word we just went through, I just noticed Gyani Vyaha, which means then the wise. So I was thinking empiricist. We hear of empiricism. Prabhupada talks about that. And in this case, it's talking about jnanis that are actually somewhat realized. So that's kind of interesting. Anyway, you probably all know what an aesthetic is. This chapter, of course, deals with mystic yoga. if anyone's been to India, they've seen wandering sadhus, you know, especially the guys that rub ashes on their body, and they wear a simple cloth, loincloth, and they carry a water pot and a stick. They usually have a walking stick. And the general term for a person who denies themselves so many things except for the necessities of life and minimizes their food, clothing, and shelter, they're known as ascetics. And they practice austerities for spiritual enlightenment. But some of them, they torture their bodies to become detached from the flesh. And one group, I was at a Kumbh Mela in Haridwar. They alternate between Allahabad and Haridwar with the Melas. And there were Nagababas at this one, and these guys don't wear any clothes at all. They're naked sadhus. And I remember I had a camera, and I had one of the security, the guards, watching me like an eagle, because if I pulled that camera up and snapped these guys going by, actually, in previous Melas, they'd had some trouble between the, some other groups, like the Vaishnavas and the Nagababas, you know, because there's certain astrological times that are auspicious for bathing in the Ganges, and that's why a lot of people go to these Melas, is to bathe with the sadhus, with the idea that they're going to wash their sins away. So that's why millions and millions of people go to these things, to wash away their sins and to associate with sadhus at an auspicious astrological alignment. So these Nagababas, they're going over this bridge, and I get this camera, and this guard's watching me, and I'm definitely, I know what that means. I do not take a picture of these guys. And otherwise, this guy's going to come over and just... he's got his stick, and he's going to ask for the camera to beat me until he gets it. So I didn't take a picture of these Nagababas, but the, there were even some Westerners in the mix, a few. And I was looking at these guys, and I'm thinking, man, I'm lifetimes, even if I wanted to do this, I'm lifetimes away from what these guys are doing. And I heard Pushkar talking about it, but I've heard from other people that they have this one practice where they hammer their genital until it doesn't work anymore, and that's how they get out of you know, it's not the ideal situation to get away from sex life, but that's kind of one of their practices. And some people in India, they think they're the best sadhus because they don't have any possessions, they don't even wear a cloth. But we know from our good fortune of coming in contact with Srila Prabhupada that it's more elevated. And Krishna is saying it here that he starts out with the aesthetics. It's interesting. I'm going to read a little something in the next purport later. But he places them in a higher position than they appear in this verse in the next purport. So some aesthetics, they might raise their arm in the air over their heads, and they keep it in that position for an extended period of time, like months. And then what happens is your arm, it's the blood just drains out of it, and it just withers like a branch of a tree. And for the rest of their lives, they're going to, you know, have that sort of arm, you know, and it's kind of a sacrifice they make. And it's, again, a little bit ghastly, the whole idea of it's not a very advanced path, you know, and it's generally to get detached from the body, you know, the bodily identification, that's a tough one to get over, but we have other methods for that. Then the empiricists are mentioned, and I'm, as I said, the jnanis are referred to here. And, but, you know, when I saw empiricists, you know, immediately I thought of the ascending method. And I have to reference these scientists that Prabhupada was so much against during his preaching when he was with us. And these empirical modern scientists, they were the enemies of religion during Prabhupada's time, especially. They start with theories, they do experiments, they try to establish some conclusions. Sometimes they cheat to get that a conclusion, but the idea was that they would do these repeatable experiments and then they would hand off their work to some other scientists in some other part of the world. And if it could be duplicated, then it was successful and it was added to the body of their so-called knowledge. And of course, they always retain the option of changing it later, which they do a lot. And their sphere of knowledge is in a world of measurement. So the ascending method, it's not a very reliable method. It's a defective method and it generally, you know, a lot of times it does not lead to spiritual realization. In fact, we've seen the opposite, you know, with these scientists. So they even had these global symposiums during Prabhupada's time where they would speculate on the origin of the universe. And at that time, you know, they made it clear to the participants in their meeting that it was anything could be put on the table except any sort of conception of God as the cause of the material world. So it's pretty demonic. And so during Prabhupada's time, they were opposed to the idea of even discussing God as the creator, and Srila Prabhupada treated them as enemies of the truth. And rightfully so. And they were also very proud, very arrogant about their technological advances, like jet planes and you know, and such skyscrapers. Where Prabhupada would say, "Well, can they, you know, create a mosquito? They can't create a mosquito, or you know." And so he would preach vigorously against them. And while they would pose as the only reasonable source of knowledge, and they would decry anything mystical coming from a religious or mystical experience as, you know, is illusion, whereas, you know, we understand their conclusions are based on the world of measurement, which is by definition the world of Maya, which by definition is illusory. So Srila Prabhupada would use the phrase "men with a poor fund of knowledge." You know, they foolishly deny anything that cannot be directly perceived through their mind and their senses, or with their extended technology like microscopes, telescopes, satellites, various forms of telecommunication, which just simply extend their ability to see, hear, or perceive something. So there's also, things have changed over the years since Prabhupada was with us, and there are more progressive scientists these days. Consciousness has been added to the equation, and consciousness throws a big monkey wrench into the whole empiric paradigm, the whole idea of approaching knowledge with the ascending method, because once you introduce consciousness, or you admit consciousness, there's a subjective experience with the objective world. And so things have changed. There's even theistic Christian scientists, but even so, the scientific establishment, and this is, I have a video that Ben Stein did called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. Actually, it's worth watching. Madhukanta Prabhu had an idea that we should do a little spiritual cinema with some select things, you know, that might, you know, that would be worth discussing. But pretty much this, it's almost a documentary, and it just illustrates that the scientific establishment is basically organized against anyone who goes against Darwinian evolution as a theory, and or tries to point it out as a theory. And they've professors have been dismissed from universities, scientists lose grants, and they lose their standing in the scientific community. And actually, all the research government grants and institutional grants are almost exclusively available for those who want to promote the atheistic point of view. And this results in textbooks that are circulated in schools across America. So the resulting educational system, which Prabhupada called slaughterhouses, is creating the lowest men imaginable. You know, there's these four types of men that reject God. And I was listening to Prabhupada give a talk in 66 in New York, where he was saying that some apparently educated college age young man, you know, announced himself as God to Prabhupada. And, you know, he started his lecture kind of in an interesting way. He said, actually, when someone grows up in a family and they see their brothers and sisters calling their father, you know, father, then naturally they join in. And so those that are familiar with the Vedas, you know, and it points towards there is a common father. And those that don't, you know, and if somebody in a regular family doesn't respect their father who's hard-earned wealth and has been being spent on his children, somebody doesn't offer respects to their father, they're considered to be very low class, you know, very abominable. And so, and that's the case, you know, those that reject our common father, Krishna, ultimately, you know, they're Naradamas. They're the lowest among men. And so the educational system is just cranking out these kind of people that just refuse to recognize God. But, you know, they're being educated like that. So the word jnani, yaha, the word that's mentioned in this verse refers to the wise, and that's the jnanis. But it's also a process of speculation, and it's a path that's not guaranteed to arrive at guaranteed to arrive at a devotional understanding of God. You know, there's rampant impersonalism amongst most jnanis. So Krishna mentions in different places in the early part of the Gita that it's a troublesome path and it may lead to liberation, but the kind of liberation is an impersonal liberation of Brahman. And so their process is 18, 18, 18, you know, the absolute truth. You know, they're trying to separate Brahman from Prakriti, from the temporary from the permanent. So it's not this, it's not that, it's not this, it's not that. And so if you eliminate all these things, then you're supposed to arrive at substance, something. And a French philosopher took this approach. He's famous, René Descartes. And he tried to eliminate everything until he found something so permanent, something so undeniable, that he had to accept it. And his famous bottom line was, I think, therefore I am. So basically he validated his existence, which is childish, really, when you think of India and the Vedas. But it's, so the jnanis, they're more dignified than, you know, the materialists. And some may arrive at the truth after a long, hard effort, and some of them may find themselves. I like what Burijan said at the end of his class of 12 cantos of Bhagavatam, and when Irmala said, okay, Burijan, you've gone methodically, you've taught the whole Bhagavatam from first canto to 12, so are you self-realized? And Burijan Prabhu said, I've realized that I'm a fool. And I like that. I like that answer. So some jnanis, those that are very intelligent, will find themselves at some point, like Newton described, that he's at the shore of an ocean, just gathering a few grains of sand, you know, that's how much he knows. At the shores of a great ocean of knowledge, he's, what he knows is insignificant. So somebody that really has a big, big brain, big capacity for understanding things, begins to think of himself as very small and insignificant. So Krishna is not encouraging that path for Arjuna. So he's mentioned this a number of times already. And right at the beginning of the chapter, in the first verse, the Supreme Personality said, one who is unattached to the fruits of his work and who works as he is obligated is in the renounced order of life. And he is the true mystic, not he who lights no fire and performs no duty. So better to act than not to act. You know, that famous quote of Shakespeare, to be or not to be, that is the question. Well, it's better to act. That's the answer. And not to simply renounce and speculate. Even if you do something wrong, by acting at some point, you will learn from that. So it's always better to act. And then the next verse, what is called renunciation, you should know to be the same as yoga or linking oneself to the Supreme, O son of Pandu, for one can never become a yogi unless he renounces the desire for sense gratification. So he's introducing in that verse, but he's mentioned it before, this idea of a detached work. You don't, your duty is to act, but you don't, you're not entitled to the fruit of action. And you certainly shouldn't work for pleasing the mind and the senses. That's a path leading to a lower life. So real renunciation is linking up, being a yogi, and not foregoing the desire for sense gratification. And then third verse of this chapter, for one who is a neophyte, the Eightfold Yoga System, and so that's the yogic system that's mentioned in this chapter. Work is said to be the means, and for one who is already elevated in yoga, cessation of all material activities is said to mean. So there's a whole process of yama, niyama. There's, you know, things to do, prohibitions, things not to do. Then there's this whole this steps, and it leads, you know, up to, you know, controlling the mind and the senses to the point where you're fit for some sort of meditation, extended concentration and meditation. Srila Prabhupada, he also mentions karma yoga in the purport. It's kind of interesting. Greater than the fruit of worker. And the fruit of worker, you would think that could refer to a materialist engaging, pursuing happiness in this world, or someone who's a little religious or a little regulated in his life. He's trying for elevation for the heavenly planets, and that's karma kanda. And the Vedas are full of this karma kanda stuff, and it's meant for gradual elevation. And if you know, you go to heaven, you get most everyone there is a devotee, so you get some, but it I was just reading in the 11th canon of Bhagavatam how it's troublesome also in the heavenly planets that there's envy and disturbances, and even though you're arranged so nicely, you're not aware that actually, you know, every moment that goes by that you're enjoying like that is just eating up your good, pious credits, so that, you know, death is coming, you know, it's going to end at some point, and you're going to be having to come back down to the middle planets. So, yeah. So from the highest planet to the lowest, all are places of misery. That's what Krishna says later on in the Gita. Brahma, Bhuvana, Loka. So this karma yoga is mentioned in the purport, and it's meant to achieve liberation. And that's done through, it's the yoga of work. And essentially, if a person works without identifying as a doer and detaches himself from the fruits, he can move towards realizing himself as the spirit, which is separate. It has nothing to do with this body. And this is also practiced by the jnanis, and they remove, you know, their involvement in their activities. They become a witness of their own activities, and even they remove their intent. You know, they try not to be the instigator of their activities. And so the detachment that you get from this can lead to a deeper experience of the soul. But of hum brahmasmi, to realize we're spirit is not enough. And the more common form of karma yoga works towards achieving bhakti, which in which a person's actions are seen as an offering of love and devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Prabhupada does such a beautiful job on this next, and he refers to the next verse twice in his purport, so I'm going to read it. And I'm going to read part of the purport, and in case, I know most of you devotees have a lot of experience, you've been around this Bhagavad Gita for many, many years, 30 years some, and more. And you're probably aware of this, but I'll say it anyway, in case there's some newer devotees on the call. On the last purport of each chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada generally sums up the whole chapter in that Gita, in that purport. So it's a useful thing to know. So this 47th verse, and today is Thursday, and you won't be hearing this again till Monday. And Prabhupada said, spiritual life means repetition. There's no harm in hearing it today. And of all yogis, he who abides in me with great faith, worshipping me in transcendental loving service, is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. So it's hard to read this one where, you know, the aesthetic, higher than the aesthetic, empiricist, the fruit of worker, is a yogi in all circumstances, be a yogi, without reading this verse, because it really, it's the next line, and it really clarifies what he means by a yogi. But of course, there are many different kinds of yogis. So Prabhupada mentions the three major paths of yoga, and now Krishna is making it clear that bhakti yogi is the path, the highest path. So in the beginning of the purport, Prabhupada takes one of the words out of the Sanskrit, because evidently Radhakrishnan's in translation or some other interpretations of Bhagavad Gita, they miss this word. And Prabhupada says that this word bhaja, that's in bhajate, is in there, but he says this word bhaja means to worship, to adore, to show respect and honor to the worthy one. So it's specifically meant for Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's no way around it. You can't, you know, worship Brahman. You're worshiping the Personality of Godhead. So Prabhupada says one can avoid worshiping a respectable man or a demigod and may be called discourteous, but one cannot avoid serving the Supreme Lord without being thoroughly condemned. You know, it just imagine Krishna's providing everything for everyone. He's maintaining everyone. And there are those that, you know, there's that that neglect him their whole lives or a large part of their lives. And then those that become awakened to the real situation, they find themselves remorseful for that, you know, and praying to the Lord that please forgive me for neglecting you. And so that's being Krishna conscious. So by constitution, we're meant to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So let's see, the Bhagavatam, he quotes the Bhagavatam, Ye Esham Purusham Shakshad, anyone who does not render service and neglects his duty unto the primeval Lord, who is the source of all living entities, will certainly fall down from his constitutional position. So even if somebody attains Brahman, he's going to have to come back to this world. Why? Because he's denying the lotus feet. He's made an offense at the lotus feet of Krishna. So he hasn't solved this problem, really. And he's going to be forced back down into this plane. So here's Prabhupada's explanation. It's succinct and it's beautiful, and it's a long purport, and you're going to hear it on Monday, but here it is. The culmination of all kinds of yoga practices lies in bhakti yoga. All other yogas are but means to come to the point of bhakti. In bhakti yoga, yoga actually means bhakti yoga. All other yogas are progressions toward the destination of bhakti yoga. From the beginning of karma yoga to the end of bhakti yoga is a long way to self-realization. Karma yoga without fruitive results is the beginning of this path. When karma yoga increases in knowledge and renunciation, the stage is called jnana yoga. When jnana yoga increases in meditation on the super soul by different physical processes and the mind is on him, it is called astanga yoga. So the Patanjali Sutras, this mystic yoga process has been described in the sixth chapter, is jnana yoga. When jnana yoga increases in meditation on the super soul by different physical processes and the mind is on him, it is called astanga yoga. And one surpasses the astanga yoga and comes to the point of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, it is called bhakti yoga, the culmination. Factually, bhakti yoga is the ultimate goal. But to analyze bhakti yoga minutely, one has to understand these other yogas. The yogi who is progressive is therefore on the true path of eternal good fortune. One who sticks to a particular point, does not make further progress, is called by that particular name, karma yoga, jnana yoga, or jnana yoga, raja yoga, hatha yoga, etc. If one is fortunate enough to come to the point of bhakti yoga, it is to be understood that he has surpassed all the other yogas. Therefore, to become Krishna conscious is the highest stage of yoga. Just as when we speak of the Himalayan mountains, we refer to the world's highest mountains, of which the highest peak, Mount Everest, is considered to be the culmination. It is by great fortune that one comes to Krishna consciousness on the path of bhakti yoga to become well situated according to the Vedic direction. The ideal yogi concentrates his attention on Krishna, who is called Shamasundar, who is as beautifully colored as a cloud, whose lotus-like face is as effulgent as the sun, whose dress is brilliant with jewels, and whose body is flower-garlanded. illuminating all sides is his gorgeous luster, which is called the Brahma Jyoti. He incarnates in different forms, such as Rama, Nrisimha, Varaha, and Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he descends like a human being, as the son of Mother Jasoda, and he is known as Krishna, Govinda, and Vasudeva. He is the perfect child, husband, friend, and master, and he is full and transcendental qualities. If one remains fully conscious of these features of the Lord, he is called the highest yogi. So, of course, on the 18th chapter, Krishna says, Manmanabhavamadbhaktomadijinamnamaskuru mama vaishashi satyam te pratijanye priyoshime. This is a verse that appears twice, actually, in the Bhagavad Gita, and it appears at the end also. Always think of me, become my devotee, worship me, and offer your homage unto me. Thus you will become to me without fail. I promise you this because you are my very dear friend. So the yoga, this bhakti yoga is meant for those that are fortunate, basically, and because we've come into contact with Srila Prabhupada, we can shortcut the whole process. We can learn about the other yogas. We don't have to spend lifetimes practicing them. We just accept on faith that Krishna's two Bhagavan Svayam. It's not hard. Veda Vyas himself states that in Bhagavatam. So, and ultimately, Premanjana Charita Bhakti Lochanena. I worship the primeval Lord Govinda, who is always seen by the devotee, whose eyes are anointed with the pulp of love. He is seen in his eternal form, Ashwara Sundar, situated within the heart of the devotee. So this beauty of the Supreme Lord can be seen by devotees who are in love with him, and devotees who are whose eyes are anointed with love of Godhead. And I just heard Prabhupada say that it's a type of seeing that's called revelation. You know, it's generally not seeing with this fleshy eye. You know, it's Krishna can't be approached by our mundane mind and senses. But he can be realized. Krishna can reveal himself to us if he's pleased with us. So one can see the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Govinda, always within himself and outside himself if one has developed a transcendental loving attitude towards him. And for people in general, he's not visible. Another place Prabhupada says, when he was present, everyone was attracted simply by Krishna's form, and because Krishna is the director of the universe, he just banished the fear of Arjuna. You know, he showed the universal form, and then he showed him his beautiful form of Krishna. So we have the opportunity to see him if we follow the instructions of his bona fide representative, Srila Prabhupada. So I'll end here. If anybody wants to say something, now's the time.
Oh, a nice class, Prabhu. Thank you.
Well, I have two things I wanted to clarify.
Sure.
Not really so much of a question. I just got to make sure I got it straight. Actually, you covered pretty good because these are questions that I had at the beginning. But I think I understand. With the translation, so we've got the ascetic, the empiricist, and then the fruitive workers.
Right.
So, but and then Krishna says, but above all, be a yogi. So the ascetic would appear to be a yogi, but because there's reference to the next verse, that yogi refers specifically to a bhakti yogi. And what makes the ascetic, what makes the empiricist or the fruit of worker, on some level of bhakti yoga is his devotion to Krishna. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. Anything, you know, I've heard devotees preaching over the years that to be successful at any of these yogas, there has to be an element of bhakti. So it depends on the mix, you know, that somebody's involved in some discipline of yoga. And if they get stuck at that level, if they're just practicing yoga for the lifetime, that's karma yoga, that's, you know, they're known as a karma yogi, as Prabhupada says in the purport. But depends on the mix. And the, yeah, I was, that's what I was trying to also understand, because it seemed like karma yoga is for the work, that verse in the beginning of the chapter, you know, for the beginners, work is said to be the means. And then for those who are advanced, you know, then, you know, they can enter into some sort of meditation or samadhi, right? They don't have to work. But it seems like, you know, it rhymes with the 12th chapter. If you can't do this, do this. If you can't do this, do this. You know, so Krishna starts with the Arjuna, well, you should remember me from moment to moment. If you can't do that, then you should follow the regulative principles of bhakti. If you can't do that, then you should work for somebody who can, associate with those, you know, that can do, you know, that sort of thing. You know, and then if you can't do that, give up the fruits of your activities, you know. And if you can't do that, meditate on yourself. Even in one of the purports in the 12th chapter, he says, meditate on yourself as the supreme. That's one of the purports. I was shocked to see that. But so if you can't do this, do this. If you can't do this, do this. So the idea is karma yoga is kind of down the ladder. And a yogi who's got some, and these aesthetics, they have some, you know, they're not materialist, that's for sure. You know, they're a little above, you know, they're not pursuing this world, right? So it is interesting what their position is, the aesthetics. But he starts out with the aesthetics, then the empiricists, the gyanis, then the karma yogis, and then, you know, so it's all yogis, but there's different kinds of yogis, and it seems to start with karma yoga, and then jnana yoga, and then jnana yoga, and then nitya yoga, or whatever. But it's, yeah, I don't know exactly the hierarchy, but I think it's a mix. It's like the modes of material nature. It's hard to, you know, to pin it down in broad strokes, because everyone's a mixture, you know, a different mixture. So the predominant yoga that somebody's following, they might be known for that. It might be an advanced aesthetic, might be an advanced tapasvi. They could be advanced. And then there could be people that are not so advanced. They're just they're torturing their bodies in some sort of ignorance. Working with the body is generally in the mode of ignorance. Working with the mind is in the mode of passion.
If I could just throw this in. So in the last words here in this verse where it says, Tasmat Yogi Bhavarjana, whatever you do, just be a yogi. So he's naming all these different types of people that are in different levels, ascetics and empiricists and fruitive workers. So he's saying in all circumstances, be a yogi, because until you add devotion to any one of these things, then they're not highly advanced.
Right. And so when I looked at this and I was preparing for the class, I was just taking it on face value. I didn't see that jnana bhyaha, you know, then the wise, you know. I was taking it to mean, you know, just those that are practicing austerities, trying to get detached from the body, those that are empiricists, you know, they're using the strength of mind to try to reach God. Fruit of workers, I'm thinking fruit of worker is just, it's not a karma yogi. You know, I'm not thinking like that. But then Prabhupada mentions karma yoga, jnana yoga, and bhakti yoga in the purport. So I have to kind of deal with that. But it looks like these things are below yogis, You know, they're not karma yogis. They're not jnana yogis. They're not, you know, they're not yogis yet. But it definitely goes with the next verse, and that's when the clarification comes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's all kinds of yogis. Yeah, so that's what it looks like to me. You know, it looks like that it's just aesthetics, empiricists, fruit of workers. They're all generally caught up in the modes. And then in all circumstances, be a yogi. You know, you don't want to be caught in the lower, you know, in a lower position than being a yogi. And then of all yogis, you know, karma yogi, jnana yogi, bhakti yogi, you should be a bhakta. You should be my devotee. But who am I? I mean, I have to go with Prabhupada on his prayer words. Anyway, that's the way I would, you know, if I didn't see the three yogas in the purport, I would have immediately just gone like that, you know, that these tapastis and empiricists and fruit of workers, they're just not even there yet. They're not yogis.
I had one other point, but does anyone else have a question or comment? No. Okay, let me ask just one other thing, because it's getting late. I just looked up in the all-knowing Wikipedia, because I was going to say, what exactly is an empiricist?
Right.
So they give a real strict sense here. Under usage, it says, the central concept in science and the scientific method is that it must be empirical, based on the evidence of the senses. Both natural and social sciences work in this hypothesis. I'm saying there's something else. Oh, here. Philosophical empiricists, which we're dealing with, philosophical empiricists hold no knowledge to be properly inferred or deducted unless it is derived from one's sense-based experiences. And it goes on and on. But
that's good. So then you're on the mind and the senses. If it's not perceivable, so that's the scientist. That's immediately where my mind went when I saw empiricist. You know, so immediately that's where I went with it. It's the ascending process, empirical, you know, idea that you can speculate your way into the truth.
Mm-hmm. But when somebody actually starts mixing bhakti yoga, then they're a jnana yogi. Because they're accepting the Vedas, they're trying to find out what the absolute truth is, but they're still relying on their senses, their mind especially. Mind,
correct.
Intelligence.
Yeah, correct. Correct. Absolutely. That's what I thought. Everybody, yeah, is not there, not a yogi yet. But then Prabhupada mentions the three yogas in the purport.
Okay.
But the next purport is, you know, just illuminating. When you read through the next purport, it's just amazing. I mean, it just puts everything into perspective.
Okay.
Okay.
Anything else?
From whom? Sorry, what's the station?
Thank you.
So tomorrow we're going to carry on with the teaching of Lord Chaitanya. Hopefully we'll get through the first chapter. Vidagi, you left off on the 10 offenses?
Right, yeah. I just finished the 10 offenses.
Just finished. Okay, I know where that area is. All right, so I'll see if I can finish up, because the following week, the 19th, Friday, Rafila will start giving her seminar on how to give a good class.
Good.
What day is this? Friday?
Friday the 19th. So
okay.
She said it would be good for her on Friday evening. So we'll just do the same thing. So we're going to just hold off on teachings of Lord Chaitanya until she goes through this seminar of hers. And I believe the way she was saying it is that on the 19th, the following Friday, it's just going to be like an introduction about the course, how, what she's going to cover, what she's going to teach, and it's kind of a general idea, overview. And then after that, that's when the course would actually start. And I'm not sure how many it'll be. The way she wrote, it looks like it's only going to be two sessions, so three altogether, the introduction, two sessions. But
can I ask a question on that?
Sure.
Is the final exam having to give a class?
Probably in a real seminar it is.
Well, you know, the reason why I asked her, do you want to do it just in a sequence or just like a couple of days together? And she said no, because she wants to space a week apart because she's going to go give us, it's a
homework.
Yeah, it's a workshop.
Yeah.
So definitely it's a matter of, you know, learning how to speak to.
Yeah. Well. I'll talk to you later about that.
Okay. So, anyway, that's what's happening.
Yeah. All right.
Forget that tomorrow, Hanuman Prasad Swami is giving class. So, see what happens. I didn't hear anything back from Kavi Chandra Maharaj. I did pay him. He didn't write me back.
I was reading something Dhaneshwar Prabhu wrote in 2007. I was interested to find him online. And he's a scholar. He's a major scholar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got a good lineup of people. Krishna's mercy. That's why I think I needed help. I told Mother Irmila just yesterday and the day before when we were talking about this class coming up, I was saying now that, you know, like Pushkar gives classes and, you know, especially now that she's been giving classes, I feel like petrified to give a class.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, she's on a roll.
So
it's hard to match up.
So what she told me was, see, that means that you think that you're giving the class and you're not letting Krishna give the class, and you know, just speak truly.
Uh-huh.
Oh, she's brilliant. She's got a fantastic answer for everything.
So I want to, that's why I think this is really valuable. I'm really looking forward to this seminar that she's going to give. I want to see how she does it, how to organize and present it in such a way that it really conveys an idea. She's really, really good. So. All right, Prabhu. So, there's nothing else. You want to close it up? You'd like to approve?
Okay. Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai. Shula Prabhupada.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. How are you guys, Prabhu?
Nice to meet you.